Welcome to a special episode of PageCast, recorded at the Open Book Festival, Cape Town's annual literary gathering, spotlighting South African writing within a global conversation. Enjoy.
Hello, my name is Bongani Kona.
And I'm Remy Ngamije.
Going to be talking today about Remy's most recent book, which is, really amazing. Only Stars Know the Meaning of Space. But as a way to begin, I've asked Remy to do something strange. So we're going to read a poem together and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah.
So the poem is titled Practicing Fadeaways and it's by a poet by the name of John Murillo.
Yeah.
You read the first stanza, I'll read the second and we'll keep going.
All right. I'm going to introduce it. It's called Practicing Fadeaways after Larry Levis. On a deserted playground in the late day sun, my palms dusted black, dribbling, a worn leather ball behind my back. This loneliness echoes from the handball courts nearby. Nearly all the markings, free throw line, sideline, center circle, rubs to nothing. A crack in the earth cuts across the schoolyard, jagged as a scar on a choir boy's cheek.
20 years ago, I ran this very court with 9 other wannabe bowlers. We'd steal through peeled chain links or hop the gate to get here. Our blacktop Eden. One boy who had a funny pigeon-toed set shot and a voice full of church bells sang spirituals every time he made a basket. The other boys humming along, laughing, high fives flying down the court.
And a boy we called the Sandman for how he put you to sleep with his shoulder fake or drop step. Over 6 feet tall in 10th grade, smooth talker with an itch for older guys' girlfriends. One Sunday morning, they found him stabbed to death outside the Motel 6, pockets untouched, bills folded neatly against his beautiful cooling thigh. And downtown Rocky Brown, whose family headed west when he was 2, but still called himself a New Yorker, who never pulled from less than 30 feet out and could bank shots blindfolded. He went to Grambling, drove himself crazy with conspiracy theories and liquor, was last seen roaming the French Quarter, shoeless, babbling about the Illuminati's 666 ways to enslave the populace.
At 16, I discovered Venice Beach with its 1,000 bodybuilders, roller skates, and red thong bikinis. I would stand on the sidelines and watch the local bowl players leaping and hollering, Quicksilver Giants, run and gun, already grown into their main bodies. Funkadelic rising from a boombox in the sand. Now, all I hear are chain nets chiming as I sink, one fadeaway after another. The blackboard, the pole, throwing a long shadow across the cracked black asphalt.
What the net wants must be this caress, this stillness stretching along every avenue over high school gymnasiums and deserted playgrounds, and the ambulance drivers drifting into naps back at the station house. What the boys who ran these courts wanted was a lob pass high enough to pull them into the sky, something they could catch in both hands and hang from, long enough for someone to snap a photograph to hold them there, skybound, risen.
Oh, man. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Yeah. And I suppose, like, as I was reading through your book, I happened to be reading the poetry collection by John Murillo at the same time. And one thing that really struck me is sort of how you both sort of grapple with masculinity, black masculinity in particular. And like, I wondered maybe if we could start the conversation there.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you gave me this poem to read, I was very shocked by the rhythm and the cadence of it, the desires for longing and friendship and the way boys become friends and what holds them together. There's always this incredible gravity in friendship, especially from my observance of male friendship. It's a sport or the love of a genre of art like hip hop, or it's being in theater together, or it's being at the same school. There's always something that holds them together. And the cadence of this poem really echoed a lot of the things that I'm writing about in Only Stars Know the Meaning of Space, because there's a group of friends, male, who have just come of age, and they're navigating the changing geographies of their friendship. People are doing things in life that maybe they didn't think they'd be doing. You know, aging changes the way friends relate to each other. And this idea, not this idea, but this feeling of like who we once were as boys starts changing when we become men, or when we have to become men, and the way those things affect friendship and connection. So this poem was like a wonderful, it feels like an echo that I didn't shout into a cave. And that's the wonderful thing about literature. You always think you're the only one shouting, and then an echo comes back from something else that you never read, never encountered. I've never heard this poem, this poet before, but playing basketball, being boys, walking our route to the basketball court, or taking a taxi to the other side of town to like absolutely drop on some grown men who we know we're going to leave this day undefeated. That feels very, very familiar. And so that's what I mean by like, it's an echo that you didn't shout out, but this is just a wonderful way to start the conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. I know now I'm moving away from my own plan, but you know, there's a line in your book, which like really, it's actually half a line. Yeah. It's half a sentence. Yeah. The character says like, people are the worst thing to happen to people. Then just a couple of lines later, he says, I want it to happen less to people. Like, that just hit me in the solar plexus.
Yeah.
But there's also like within the characters themselves, I think in other places of the world, it's called machismo, like a pretense of kind of machismo. But underneath that is also like real hurt, like it's covering up a lot of other things. And I wonder if you just speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, so, you know, when you cross a river and a crocodile bites your leg off, or you go surfing and a shark bites your arm off, those things are acting within their nature. It is not unnatural. But when people do things to each other, when they're unkind to each other, those things are deliberate choices, because we are gifted with some sort of agency and will. So there's nothing very accidental. A lot of things are very deliberate, you know? And so when the character says people are the worst things to happen to each other, it's true in a way. It's very hard to be eaten by a lion unless you've done something to be in the same space as this lion to eat you. But when you greet me in the morning and say, hello, Remy, how are you? And I come back to you with an unkind word. There's always a moment where I could have paused and thought, don't do this, retract, do something better. And the way we interact with people in the daily world, all of these things are choices. To be unkind to someone, kindness is free, but we choose unkindness. That's a deliberate choice, you know, that we make. And so within the context of the writing, a lot of the characters, they have machismo, and it really uses a shield to insulate their very soft and vulnerable cores. And it's sad because those soft, vulnerable cores, if they were exposed, one, of course, life is, the world is the way it is. You could be hurt, but it could lead to so many wonderful connections and things happening in your life. And so within the course of the writing, course of writing this, I was also not directly exploring the way I relate to the world, but just the choices you make when you start becoming a man or being forced to become a man, and the choice to be remain either soft or to become hard. It's almost like a polar thing and a polarizing thing where there's only this, you either remain soft and you hurt, or you become hard and you hurt people. And those two choices, I don't think are the only ones that exist. But the characters in the book, the way they navigate this very complex situation, that's what I was really interested in, how, whether they're brave enough, whether you're courageous enough to embrace freedom. Because as a man, what I've noticed is that the freedom exists to be another way. But it's whether you're strong enough and courageous enough to embrace that freedom, because that freedom comes at a price. You might lose your friends. You might lose your social circle. You might lose the ego or the thing, that idea you've built up about yourself or the world has built up about you. So are you courageous enough to enjoy this freedom that exists, but to let go of certain aspects of masculinity that you might not, that might not be good for you? Yeah.
That was very beautiful. Speaking of the freedom to be another way, talk to me about dancing. Talk to me about salsa dancing.
Yeah, so dancing is something that I got into when I was in Cape Town, when I was in what I'd call my formative years. This is somewhere that magic age between 20 and 21. I think I would have been closer to 24 when I got into it. It was something that I got into because my friends, for years, I've been trying to get me into this thing, and I was never brave enough to do it because I was like, nah, bro, that's not how we roll. Until I was myself in, I guess you could call, the throes of heartbreak. And I was sitting at home playing like Adele and Coldplay, like on repeat. And one of my friends who was in charge of looking after me that Friday night was just like, I can't do this. We're going, go shower, put on clothes. We're going dancing. And I went and I didn't know how to get involved in this thing. I didn't know what was happening in this world. And we went to the Granddaddy Hotel. Yes. And we're dancing. Well, they were dancing and I was sitting and I was watching. And something about watching other men who I really admired and look up to and who were tall, dark, handsome, muscled, chiseled, well-spoken, suave, seeing them dance and be free with themselves. It sort of like reminded me how, I guess, I'd been constricted myself. Like, I wouldn't do this thing because I'm just like, this is not what we do. Like, I play ball, guys, and I lift weights. I don't dance. But I saw that. And Monday, I signed up for class. So again, that freedom was there. And thank goodness I was courageous enough to do it. And I've pursued it since. And so when I moved back to Namibia, I started a salsa dancing collective. And it was the only one in the country for like about 9 years. We moved from place to place because, you know, rent is rent. And these things don't always pay. But we did it for 9 years. And then I got the opportunity to open a salsa studio in the club. And we ran that for like about 4.5 steady years. We had to close it about 2 years ago, and it was a loss. And I realized through this period of loss of not doing this thing that dance was not something that I did, but something that I was, you know. And again, I come back to that thing. There's a wonderful, when you see a particular kind of man you've always interpreted as being this way, express freedom and joy and love and sensitivity and caring in another way, it almost shocks you and realizes how you are repressed by particular choices you make or the society or world that you live in. And then you have a choice. Do you want to embrace this freedom or do you not want to embrace this freedom? And for me, dance is probably the clearest example of some that like, I'm going to put my prejudice away. I'm going to put away my ego and I'm going to pursue this thing and see. And that's how I wound up in being a salsa instructor in one of my many other lives. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. Beautiful. Yeah. Again. Yeah. So the last time we spoke in like a setting such as this was after the release of this incredible debut novel, Eternal Audience of One. And now you have another incredible collection of short stories.
Thank you.
Talk to me about the distance between this book and this book. And
they both inhabit the same geographic time frame in the sense that I finished Eternal Audience of One and I was busy experimenting with short story writing because my novel had not been picked up yet. And so I was in the same life space. I was experimenting with the form because I didn't have rules. I come from a literary community where there's no Bongani corner who has published this before you, and so you are canonical. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to be experimenting in this space, literary community where there's no rules, there's no canon. You can just do whatever it is that you want. Mm-hmm. And the difference between those, when I was writing a novel, I was very clear I wanted to go from page one to page whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But with this, because I was just like, well, I've already done that thing. Let's experiment with this other thing. Let's start this story here, cut it off here, and see if we can stitch a narrative here. And then maybe the reader will be smart enough, will have enough information to sort of like bring the puzzle together and say, wait, do these things match? How do I orientate this story so that it fits into this jigsaw puzzle? And so I presume maybe the Eternal Audience song will be an album, a proper album in the sense like this is the body of cohesive work I want to put out. I've structured the narrative chapter by chapter to this. It's still highly experimental within the text itself at a language or a storytelling level, but the Only Stars is like a mixtape. And a mixtape, by that I mean by like I grew up in an era where there were very, very detailed recordings of rappers entering a basement. 5, 6, 7 grown men in a basement with just a microphone and someone playing beats. Mm-hmm. And these very grown men would just rap for hours. And you don't know what they're going to say. Sometimes the trick will be like, you end on that word and let's see if I can pick up the flow there. And everyone's got different styles, but they're engaged in this universal thing called hip hop and rap. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do that with short stories. this is like me when there's no rules, when there's just a beat and now you must drop words. Mm-hmm. And there was a wonderful time frame in which to be writing these stories because it felt to me like I was in a state of flow. Mm-hmm. When you're just like, you're going to snatch sunfire and make art out of this thing. And it's possible because you just are that person. It was, and I was doing it in a space where there was no audience, where there was no feedback. And so experimentation again was wonderful because there was no fear of judgment or failure at the time that I commenced the writing. Of course, as stories got picked up more and more, you get audience, you start maybe changing things here because you realize, oh, the stage upon which I'm performing is a little bit bigger than I thought. But the genesis, it's just you and the craft. And that is a wonderful state to be in. And it's a state that I'm chasing to be back in again, but with different stories, with different forms of writing. So there's been wonderful, but the publication is later. So Only Stars comes after Eternal Order and so on. Between that phase, I've been fortunate, super lucky enough to be exposed to other writers, to be exposed to other literature, to have things like being flown out to the Open Book Festival, to be on podcasts with you, to meet writers that I've only thought I'd ever see on a bookshelf. And there's been a lot of maturing as a writer that does not necessarily show itself on the page. So books are like weird things because when they're published, the writer moves on, but the book stays still. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to correct myself. Yeah. Thank you again. That was really beautiful.
Yeah.
It is a literary mixtape.
Yeah.
It has an A and a B side.
Yeah.
Do you want to just talk about both the A and the B side?
I wanted to, again, I'm in this state of experimentation when I want to do crazy things with the form because nobody is around to tell me otherwise. And I want to write this collection of short stories that I don't want to be labeled as a collection of short stories because that already creates in the reader's mind, oh, there's 12 to 15 short stories arranged in this way. I'm going to read them in this way. But I wanted a collection where the A side, at least when I started writing, I was maybe 3, 4, 5 stories. I was like, oh, this is what I'm trying to do. I wanted a broken narrative that you can read each piece individually, all right? And then I wanted a B-side that you could read those pieces individually. But if they were presented to you in a particular way, you could be like, wait, is that thing from there? Is it this thing that they're not speaking about here? And I wanted the reader to be presented with an option about how they experience this. A cassette, you can play halfway to the end and then you can rewind and play the whole thing. So with this A side and B side, you can read the A side just by itself. You can read the B side just by itself. You can read A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. You can read B, A, B, A, B, A, B. I wanted the reader to have a choice about how they experience this because that's how I enjoy discovering and listening to music. Yeah.
Awesome. Please, let's get the voice from the book into the room. So.
All right. So I'm going to be reading from Franco, from the Lost City of Atlantis. Oh, Franco, let me find this page. So I should have marked this down. There we go, 227. Yeah. And the reason why I'm going to read from this is because my wonderful friend Bongani chose it and because this is the story that got the Eternal Audience of One published. My literary agent in New York saw the story in a wonderful publication called American Codata and sent me the best Instagram DM I've ever got. Wow. And based from that, the Eternal Audience of One got picked up and then Only Stars Meaning of Space became possible. So I'm going to read this story. It's called From the Lost City of Atlantis to the Streets of Eldorado, or Franco. I know Franco is in a fucked up place because he still refers to his ex as his girlfriend by accident when his mood is chipper. It just slips out like a squeaky fart. And no matter how much he clenches up after that, it's already too late. Things are never the same after someone hears you fart. Sometimes it's best when he rambles on about how she was a good one and how he should have done better. It means he's focusing on the issue. Sure, it's regret, but at least he zeroes in on the object of his pain. When he's silent, I get worried. That's when a dude is liable to do something that puts him on page 3 of the newspaper. Some of the boys think he's doing well because he shows up to parties, but I know he's in trouble. A vet knows a vet. The way he glazes over at bars mid-conversation means I need to get him home, quick, fast. It's in the silence, when his eyes go dark, when he's slow to reply. That's when he's fighting the tiller, liable to get storm-clapped, wake up on the shores of the lost city of Atlantis, demons, dementia, desperation, and all. He is still cut up about her. It's in everything he does. The way he misses a simple pass on the court means he's thinking about Carmen being in the stands, seeing her face where it's not. When our team takes an L, he sighs and charges to the sideline, waiting to see who's got next. This is the same Franco who used to go coast to ghost on players. Nearly untouchable when he was in the zone, snatching ankles, sliding defenders, swishing from all corners of the court. Now, here's a liability. He could walk into a Cavaliers game and feel right at home.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Bongs. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah.
I think there's so much we could talk.
Yeah.
I could talk to you about. Like, I'm interested in your use of the second person.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your writing of, your writing of Windhoek in particular,
yeah, yeah,
and what it means, what the city means to mm-hmm. you. I wanted to speak to you about Duke, which is like a fantastic
literary organization that I run. Yeah.
Yeah. A fantastic literary organization but I'm aware that you're out of time.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you about hope because that's a thing that's like, really.
So in this collection, I was also dealing with the reality that, you know, the times we were approaching and the times we're in now, it's very hard to be optimistic when you look at the reality of life. And the character has this very naive look at the world where he says, like, hope is for the unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you're prepared, you'll be able to get through any disaster. But that's not actually how it is. Hope is what happens when you've prepared and things have still gone wrong. And I feel like we're living in a moment where, despite everyone's best attempts, despite everyone's planning, doing what we were told to do as young people, work, graduate, save, get married, have kids, everything, things are still going wrong. And so it is at those moments where you lean into that sense of hope, where you feel like, I've prepared as best as I can. I've done what I could. And now we have to hope that other people have also prepared as well they could, and that they're doing the daily actions it takes to turn our individual and communal situation around. And then hopefully things will be better. And that's why hope is so fragile, I guess, and why it's important, because it's what happens when you've done everything right that you could humanly do, but they've still gone wrong. And that's when you're like, I hope things work out. And you do that. You embrace that uncertainty, not knowing where things are going, but knowing from a place of comfort that I did what I could. And what more can you do as a person when you've done the best that you can with all available information and all the available resources to you? You just hope. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you so much. And thank you for this incredible mixtape. And man.
Thank you so much. You. It's always a pleasure chatting to you. And thanks for making all of this possible, man.